Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. So it's time to forget all the jokes you know about old people. After decades of practice in generalization and abstraction, older people are better at a few things, at many things, at seeing the big picture. They can predict the future more easily. They tend to be more accepting of individual differences, and they can regulate their emotions better and focus on the good stuff. But a societal aversion to the myths of aging can counteract all that good stuff. Daniel Levitin is the best-selling author, neuroscientist, and cognitive psychologist. His new book is titled Successful Aging: A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. Welcome, Daniel Levitin, to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
You want to redefine age as a developmental stage. I think that was one of the more intriguing concepts in the book to me and what attracted my attention. What's the distinction?
Well, you know, we tend to see, and as you say, it's a societal narrative. We tend to see old age as just this sort of separate part of the lifespan where it might be marked by decline and infirmity and depression, but the research just doesn't bear out that characterization. It's perhaps clear to us that infancy and toddlerhood and the teenage years are unique developmental stages, young adulthood, and they're characterized by different hormonal balances in our brains, different processes happening in our bodies. All of these stages are characterized by challenges and by advantages, and old age is no different.
Where do things come from, like you can't teach an old dog new tricks then?
Well, of course, not all aphorisms are true.
True.
But there is some truth to that, which is that certainly with canines, it's very difficult.
I can't teach my young puppy new tricks, so.
Yeah, well, you might need Caesar, the dog whisperer.
Right.
With humans, it's true, as with dogs, there is a developmental stage where the brain is hungrily soaking up new information, and it's very easy to learn things. And the learning takes on a different quality. Learning a language before age 10, for example, is effortless compared to learning it after age 20. Not impossible, though. Older adults can learn new languages. I moved to Quebec when I was 50 and learned to speak French at 50. And I wouldn't be confused with a native speaker, but I don't consider myself particularly good with languages. Neither did my teachers, by the way, but I did learn it. It's just that we have to be a little bit more persistent, and we have to fight against the complacency of not wanting to learn new things as we age.
You know, there's another thing about your book, which is, you know, received lots of acclaim by all kinds of people, is that you really drill down into the neuroscience of all of this. It's not just a, you know, for lack of a better term, it's not a self-help book. It's really, first you're educating people about why you're coming to these conclusions.
Well, you know, and there's nothing wrong with self-help books. I believe we should help ourselves. But I also believe that it's very hard to do things and stick to them if you don't understand the why behind them. And I've devoted my life to being an educator, and I believe that education works. So the book is divided into three parts. And the first part is basically the science behind different processes that neuroscience has learned about and can describe, basically from birth until the end of life, processes like memory, thinking, intelligence, problem solving, personality change. And then the second part of the book is some practical advice about things that you can do, we all can do, really, starting at any age, even in our 20s. That can help put us on a path where we're going to be happy with the way we age. And then the third part, in addition to summing up, looks at the future. What breakthroughs might we expect to see in the coming 10 years?
Speaking of breakthroughs, a big one has been our understanding of neuroplasticity, that the brain can change, because a lot of this goes back to the brain and the patterns that are established there. And incredible things have changed in the last 20 years as far as our understanding of that, right?
Yeah. Norman Doidge popularized a lot of this, the Canadian psychiatrist who wrote The Brain That Changes Itself. Of course, there's also Luann Brenzedine's, Jill Bolt Taylor's book on my stroke of insight, how a stroke changed her. And neuroplasticity is just a fancy way of saying the brain can rewire itself. And really, that's what learning is. Anytime you learn something, your brain is rewiring itself. And we find now an appreciation for the idea that this can happen at any age, and the rewiring and the learning can happen well into your 80s and 90s. And, in putting the book together, I wanted to not just review the science. I wanted to review the human side of things, to hear stories about people who are doing well and try and extract some common principles, to meet people who are doing well and talk to them about what they think is going on. And there are a lot of different ways that people approach, let's say, the final third of their lives, final quarter of their lives. And there are a lot of inspiring stories out there.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Daniel Levitin. He's a neuroscientist, cognitive psychologist, best-selling author. His new book is titled Successful Aging, A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. If you have a question for Daniel Levitin going forward, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's a way you put it, Daniel, in the book, that the first part of our life is, one thing, and then there's then we get old and we get sick, and then the end part of our life is sort of like dying, or at least that's the way we visualize it.
Yeah, and I make an important distinction. We talk about lifespan, which of course is the period of time for when you're born to when you die.
Mm-hmm.
But your lifespan can be divided into two parts. Generally speaking, there is the health span, the span of time during which you're healthy and feel healthy, and then there's the disease span. And I'm not talking about maybe you got the flu and you were out for a couple of weeks, or maybe when you were 20 you had mono and you were out for a month. I'm talking about the long trajectory where, generally speaking, most people live healthy lives until at some point in older age they get sick and then they die, whether it's from cancer or heart disease or whatever it is. There's a lot of research money going into extending lifespan,
mm-hmm,
without making that distinction between health span and disease span. And for me, and this is everybody's got to decide for themselves, but for me, the end goal isn't to necessarily live longer. I don't think I want to live to 200 if it means the last 110 years I'm going to be sitting in a nursing home in a stupor.
Mm-hmm.
What's the point of that? What I want to know is how I can increase the lifespan increase the health span within the lifespan and have that take up a larger proportion of the lifespan.
And the fact is that this didn't used to be an issue because we didn't live that long, but now we are living longer. As you mentioned, the research going into making us live longer.
Right, we are. And we're, there's this funny paradox where we're living long enough to get diseases that we didn't used to get as a society.
Yeah.
Like cancer and adult onset diabetes and heart disease. I'm fairly certain that in 10 years we'll have cured a lot of cancers that are killing people now. And then, we'll live long enough to die of something else.
What are we learning about aging at this point because we're living longer? I mean, the neuroscientists must be going crazy looking at old brains.
Well, We're just on the cusp of understanding Alzheimer's. My colleague Stan Prusner at UC San Francisco, who discovered prions and won the Nobel Prize for it, which are associated with Jakob Creutzfeldt disease, he now thinks that prions are involved in Alzheimer's. There was a lot of research on medications that might be able to address this. None of them have worked so far, but you know, this is a very active area. Neuroscientists are seeing that as we age, our brains shrink. That seems to be a normal part of aging, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you get stupider or have memory problems just because your brain shrinks. The interesting thing there is, well, certainly brain size can't be everything, because if that were true, then big-headed people would be smarter than small-headed people, and you know they aren't. But the cutting edge of the neuroscience says that there are these anomalies we haven't figured out. Some people with Alzheimer's have these prions, some don't. Some have these neurofibrillary tangles that are characteristic, some don't. Some people with the brain markers of Alzheimer's don't actually have any symptoms. So it's a confusing time for neuroscientists, but I have to say it's a good time to be alive. This is probably the best time to be alive in history in terms of health and longevity.
What role will culture play going forward in making sure that it's a sustained good time? That because I'm thinking more and more people are aging, they're living longer, and if they take your advice and the advice of others, want to do more with their lives, but the infrastructure, that kind of a thing, could be a problem.
Yeah, so you know, today for the first time ever, there are more people over the age of 65. Than under five. And within 10 years, one in five Americans will be over age 65, and they will outnumber people under age 18. So there is this demographic change, largely, as you pointed out, because we're living longer. What it means for society is, well, if you're 100 and you've got children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren and maybe great-great-grandchildren, as a very practical matter, you probably need a bigger Thanksgiving table. But I think it also is a good time for us to reevaluate the role of older adults in society. Japan has the largest number of centenarians, and Japanese culture venerates the elders, as do Native American cultures. Many cultures do. In general, we Americans don't venerate older adults so much. And the neuroscientifically speaking, oldsters have a lot to contribute. As you pointed out at the top of the hour, and I think it bears repeating, oldsters are much better and faster at seeing the big picture. And they have the ability to make better predictions about what will happen next more easily than younger generations, because they're better at seeing the patterns. And they're better at solving problems, particularly interpersonal problems and practical problems, again, because they've had so much more experience. I see older adults as a vast untapped resource that could be contributing to society, to our communities, and to the world, if only given the opportunity.
We are talking about how to age successfully. My guest is Daniel Levitin. He's a neuroscientist. He's a cognitive psychologist and author of many books, best-selling, including his newest, Successful Aging, A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. We'd love to hear from you. Hear what you think leads to successful aging. The number is 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about aging well, physically and emotionally. My guest is Daniel Levitin. He is a neuroscientist, a cognitive psychologist, and best-selling author. His new book is titled Successful Aging, A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Daniel Levitin, you devote the first part of your book to the discussion of personality. What do we mean by personality?
Well, personality is that a collection of things that make us different from others that are not particularly physical features, like tall and short or brown hair or blonde hair. Personality, of course, is a whole constellation of things about are we generous or stingy? Are we outgoing or introverted? Are we open to new experience or somewhat set in our ways? Are we agreeable or disagreeable? Are we neurotic or emotionally stable? And there are thousands of ways that we differ from one another. And, you know, together we call that our personality. In younger children, we see it even in the sandbox, in little kiddos. Anybody who's ever been to a nursery school has seen that very young children already demonstrate these kinds of qualities, which suggest they're partly genetic.
You make the point that personalities can change. You can change your personality. And it plays a big role in aging successfully. And that reminded me, maybe it's from coming out of the holidays, but of the Dickens story, of course, of Ebenezer Scrooge. Now, obviously, he's visited by three ghosts in one night in that story. But in real life, what do we really mean by changing personalities?
Well, we do change our personalities as we develop. One of the things we do in junior high school and high school is we realize for the first time in our lives that we don't have to just like the things that our parents like or that they told us to like. We can choose our own friends. We like certain people. We can choose what music we want to listen to, what courses of in school we like better. And that's effectively a change of personality or a development or focus of it. And all the major religions teach us to be more compassionate and more tolerant and more loving, more grateful. Those are qualities of the personality, and religions teach us we can change it, as does science. And the entire field of psychotherapy is based on the idea that you can change, as is meditation. The idea is to develop a calmer personality or a more focused, attentional personality. All these are different paths to get there, but the importance of personality to aging is that it turns out statistically there are two components of personality that pretty much drown out other factors in terms of how well you're going to do throughout the lifespan.
What are those?
One of them is conscientiousness, a whole cluster of traits surrounding being dependable and reliable and doing the things that you say you'll do, and you know, being a good friend and being you know, following rules. So conscientious people tend not to get put in jail, and they tend to go see the doctor when they're sick, and when the doctor tells them what to do, they do it. And then they get better, provided they have a good doctor. And a conscientious person, if they don't have a good doctor, they find a good doctor. This is something you can develop. It's you can increase your conscientiousness either by force of will or through therapy, depending on your own mode of change that you prefer. And, of course, moderation is the key here. People who are overly conscientious might become obsessive-compulsive, and that's no good. Hmm. So you have to find the right balance. The other big personality factor is openness. I would combine it with curiosity. People who are curious about the world and are open to having new experiences tend to fare better in life. Again, not being overly curious and putting yourself in hazardous situations, but a curiosity mindset engenders gratitude. You look around the world and you see all of its wonder. You're curious about it. You're grateful for it. And those things are very healthy for the brain.
I'm talking with Daniel Levitin. He's a neuroscientist, cognitive psychologist, a best-selling author. His new book is titled Successful Aging, A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. If you have a question or comment for Daniel Levitin, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Francis in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Francis.
Hi. Well, he just took my idea.
He did not. I want you to explore that with us.
As an octogenarian, my whole thing is curiosity. Just as when I was waiting online for you, the fellow came in and said, going to have a break, and I asked him, why is the program on TV different from what I'm hearing in my phone? And he said, you're on two different systems. And I said, that's what I'm talking about, curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I watch your program all the time. I'm learning more and more about my computer. When I have a health issue that's new or whatever, I ask the doctor what's going on, what medication is giving me, why is giving me, what do I expect? I am curious.
Have you always been like that, Francis?
My God, yes.
Okay.
I'm still the 5 and 6 year old child who wants to see how things work. I've always been curious.
That's a great story, Francis. And how long have you lived in Columbus?
I moved here in August of 1987.
Columbus is a fabulous city. Columbus is a fabulous city. I've visited many times. I've got colleagues at OSU. I'll bet there are parts of Columbus you have not explored yet.
Absolutely. But one thing is, right now, it's health issues, being able to get around. But the curiosity is still there. The ability is not there. I would still like to do things. But again, I've got health issues that stop me from doing them. But again, I was doing something with my computer, and my daughter got me a new keyboard for Christmas. And I figured out how to plug that thing in and get it to work. And I've done other things with my computer and things like that that a lot of people of my age don't do. But then they're not curious enough to figure out or even want to know how this thing works. Most of the time, I like to drop kick it, but anyhow, I figure things out. But it's that word, curious. Hmm. How do things work? Why does this happen? That's to me is the important thing.
And that's Francis. Thank you so much. You have defined a set of principles for a long and healthy life. It's called Coach, and the coach represents the word curiosity, right, Daniel Levitin?
Yeah, so this is just an acronym to help you remember the things that help. COACH. The first C is curiosity. Maintain your curiosity. The O is be open to experiences and new ideas, new people. I might as well run through the other three while we're here. A is for associations. Too many times as we age, we shrink our social circles. I mean, at the extreme ends of life, I met with George Shultz a few months ago, the former Secretary of State under Reagan, and Secretary Shultz was saying at his age, at 99, almost everybody he used to know is dead, but he still shows up at work every day, and he makes an effort to meet young people, to keep young associations going. And to keep his social network going. He actually told me a funny story. When I went to see him, his office was piled high with file folders. And I said, what is all this? And he says, well, these are boxes that we had brought up from the storage room. said, I started working on this project 15 years ago, and I didn't have the expertise to finish it myself. And he says, now I don't have the energy at 98, 99 years old. He says, but I found this young colleague who is an expert on this, and he's working with me. And all these folders on the left side of the desk are the one he's already gone through, and the ones on the right side of the desk are the ones he's going to do this afternoon, get started on this afternoon. He says, I can't believe how much progress we're making on this research and how much energy this guy has. His name is Jim Timby. So I said, Mr. Secretary, how old is a young, energetic Jim Timby? And Schultz says, 75.
Right. It's all relative, too. Francis brought up something that you mentioned, and someone like George Schultz probably doesn't have to grapple with this as much as he's probably pretty well off and has a lot of resources. But the shrinking of social circles often is a function of just an inability to get out and expand those social circles.
That's exactly right. And I think there are different things we can do. Certainly, mobility problems can curtail your being able to get out in the world and do things. Weather can. Some people choose to invite people over, start a reading group, a bridge group, anything to get people interacting with you. It turns out that what you and I are doing right now, having a conversation, is the most complex cognitive operation that humans can undertake. From a brain standpoint, it's more complex than brain surgery, than rocket science, than being a concert pianist, an astronaut. It requires a lot of different mental operations, especially when the interaction is in person. Most communities have programs either through civic organizations or through religious organizations where oldsters who are stuck in their homes can appeal to have youngsters come by and talk to them, or even adults who are their age but mobile. And that's important. It's important not to shut yourself off.
You know, a big message in your book is that we shouldn't try to slow down as we age. And for a lot of people, that means that we shouldn't look forward to retirement, or at least a time of retirement that is idle, right? It doesn't mean you can't retire from the job you have for 40 years, but maybe you can do something different and you should.
That's exactly right. So what we see over and over again is that people who retire, depending on what retirement means, if you retire and it means being idle, that seems to accelerate a rather steep decline, both physical health and mental health. But whether you stay at your job or find other meaningful work through volunteerism or even just intellectually or emotionally stimulating activities, such as going to see plays at a community playhouse or having a reading group or what have you, these activities are essential to staying young, and I would boil it down to two things: having an active social network and having meaningful experiences in which you feel valued. A lot of oldsters I hear from are volunteering in hospitals, just to go and speak with the patients there. Or I know a couple who go to a prison, a high security prison. Not because it's fun, but because it's a way for them to help give something to the prisoners that they wouldn't otherwise have in terms of companionship.
Your findings about aging and depression might surprise folks, because we do hear about these higher rates among older people and also younger people now. I guess that's where the big change is, but among older people, rates of suicide. So can you talk about what you found, the increase and the decrease in happiness by age?
Well, overall, the trend is that people tend to get happier as they age, which might seem counterintuitive. Across a number of studies, the peak age of happiness, and this is across more than 70 countries, is age 82. Now, that's certainly not true for everybody. We are seeing increased suicides among older adults, and we're seeing incidents of depression. The problem is that many doctors look at older adults, and the older adult comes to the doctor and says, I'm depressed. And the older doctor says, well, you're 85. You're expecting too much. And I think that's the wrong attitude. It's a doctor who is not being compassionate and not using what is at his or her disposal. Old age depression is a very real thing. It manifests itself differently than younger age depression. So it's not often a sense of hopelessness. It's simply a loss of energy and zest and love of life. It's a loss of taking joy in the things that normally would bring you joy. It has a different flavor than, say, depression at 25 or 45. And antidepressants among the elderly, when they're not harmful because of some other medical condition, can be very, very helpful. I had a personal experience with this that I relate in the book. I had a favorite professor named John Pierce, who was 80 when I met him. And towards the end of his life, around 85 or 86, he did grow depressed. His eyesight was failing. He had Parkinson's disease. But I suggested he ask his doctor about Prozac. He started taking it, and he felt 20 years younger. And he went out feeling really good.
We are talking about how to age well, both physically and emotionally. My guest is Daniel Levitin. He's a neuroscientist, cognitive psychologist, author of several books. His latest is titled Successful Aging, A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about aging well, both physically and emotionally. My guest is Daniel Levitin. He is a neuroscientist, a cognitive psychologist, and best-selling author. His newest book is titled Successful Aging, A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. I thought about you probably last week before we came back from the holiday. We had just gotten the Disney Plus channel, and the first thing I watched Dan was Pollyanna. and when I was watching it, it struck me from, I was also reading your book at the same time and thinking about that positive attitude and her, her Pollyanna's point of view, which has sort of been derided and is kind of a pejorative in a way. But the thing about, well, this is not so good, but I'm happy that I have this, looking forward to what's good about the situation instead of only, the glass half full, glass half empty kind of a thing. It sounds sort of dorky, but what do you think?
Well, it's complicated. I think the pejorative aspect of Pollyanna-ish, being a Pollyanna, is that if you take it to the extreme, you're not going to deal with some realities that face us. You can't just look at climate change and say it's all going to work out. There are a number of political issues that face us now, poverty, homelessness, racism, unequal distribution of resources around the planet, people who lack water and toilets, all these kinds of problems. In the extreme, if you just try to look at the positive, you're not going to deal with these problems. And I think as a planet, we have to figure out solutions, not to mention the kinds of intra and international aggressions we see. So On the other hand, if you focus solely on all that's wrong with the world, even though it may motivate you to try to fix it, you'll be a pretty unhappy person. And that unhappiness will take its toll and perhaps not allow you to come to the kinds of solutions and come to them with the kind of energy needed to actually get anything done. Now, I'm not saying all of us need to solve all of these problems, but, I mean, we're talking in broad strokes mm-hmm. here. And even just looking at your own life, if you've got that growth that looks funny and you think, oh, well, it's probably nothing, and you don't go to the doctor, and it turned out to be a melanoma, that's a bad example of glass half full. So it's a matter of moderation, really, of trying to find that balance that works for you.
Let's see. Mary Ellen in Columbus, you're on the air with Dan Levitin. Hi, Mary Ellen.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I love hearing the author talk about the creativity aspect and the social interaction. I'm 75, and I live in a senior community, which has a community center, and we have a social chairman who organizes a lot of trips and activities. And I work because I love working. I'm a medical librarian, and I love my profession, so I still work part-time, and I'm volunteer for a senior group. And I find that my life is very full, and I see some of my neighbors who really don't do anything. They might play cards one night a week or go on an occasional trip, but they don't have the curiosity that some of us have. And I really, really think that's the key. You've got to keep your mind open. You have to be interested in others and learn. Read, learn, watch good TV shows that are educational. So I'm also happy to hear that we get happier as we age. So I'm going to be really happy when I'm 82.
Mary Ellen, thank you so much for your call. Dan Levitin, she kind of covered all the bases there for a second.
Yeah, it's you know, having heard now from Francis and Mary Ellen, I think people who know someone like that should spend more time with people like that. It's inspiring and encouraging.
Mary Ellen, thanks for that call. Paul in Reynoldsburg, you had a suggestion. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Yes, good morning. Say I'm a healthy young person at age 68, but my dad passed away a few years ago, and we had a thing every Saturday night. I would go visit him, and after Lawrence Welk, we would call all of his friends. So after he passed away, I kept this list of friends. They're all between about 88 and 95 now, and I call them on holidays, and invariably, they just love to hear from somebody outside and know someone's thinking about them. They're always very thankful every time I call them or send a Christmas card, birthday card, Easter card, just anything. So I just wanted to suggest to people that are younger and maybe even younger retired people like my age, that they keep up with the older folks and let them know that they're still thinking about them.
Thank you, Paul. That is wonderful. What do you think, Dan?
I've got nothing to add. Beautifully stated, Paul.
Beautiful. Christy in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Christy.
Hi there. I'm actually calling in as a child of a parent who my father was an executive for the same company really since we moved from Canada to the United States. And he loved his job. He was totally wrapped around it, loved going in every day, talked about it all the time. And it was kind of like his entire life. And surprisingly, the company went out of business when he was almost 70 years old and was left with, you know, what does he do as a 70-year-old trying to find a new job? Didn't really have any hobbies. He had just kind of wrapped his whole life. You know, his whole world was around that job. So I guess my question is, as a child, I never looked at it and said he's unhappy, because he wasn't. He just didn't have anything else really, other than the family and the job. Hmm. So I guess my question is, you know, how to navigate through that and, you know, what could we have done differently?
Hmm. That's interesting. Dan Levitin?
Well, it's tricky, and maybe there's nothing you could have done differently. Maybe you did all you could. It's hard to know. I wouldn't dwell on what you might have done. Who knows whether he would have been responsive to any advice you gave him. What the book talks about are some cases where people were facing a similar situation in my own family. So I'm very moved by your story, and it touches me because my own grandfather was kicked out of the hospital and out of the department that he founded at age 62 because they wanted to make way for younger people. And he really went into a physical and mental decline and died young at 67, I think in part because he didn't feel valued anymore, although we sure valued him in the family. That wasn't enough. pardon me. My father was pushed out of his job at about the same age. And he figured, well, he'd retire. He had a bunch of things he wanted to do. He was looking forward to it. But within a few months, he grew very depressed. And all of us in the family were concerned that what would happen to my grandfather, would happen to him. And he picked himself up by the bootstraps, and he went and got a job as a teacher. And at 87 now, he was just given a 4-year extension on that contract, and he's thriving. The students love him. He loves the work. It's a bit challenging, but not too much, enough to keep him on his toes. And my father's mother, after she lost her husband, she was one of the few women who had earned a college degree in 1920. She had spent her life being a doctor's wife and not having a job. And after her husband died, she was adrift for quite a while and began to slip into a depression. And this was during the Johnson administration when the Head Start program had just begun. And so she volunteered to read to inner city children twice a week. And it was very fulfilling and meaningful for her. It got her out of the house, but she felt like she was doing a valuable service to the community. There are dozens of different paths to find your way once you lose your job. And I'd say just try to be creative and talk to people for advice. Make it known that you'd like to volunteer in a hospital or in a religious organization or a community organization of some sort, a soup kitchen, anything, really.
Thank you, Christy, for that call. My guest, Daniel Levitin, neuroscientist, cognitive psychologist, author of the book Successful Aging, A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. He's defined a set of principles for a long and healthy life called COACH. That's the acronym. It stands for Curiosity, Openness, Associations, Conscientiousness, and Healthy Practices. Dan, we haven't talked a bit about what we mean by healthy practices. Diet and exercise, right?
And sleep hygiene.
And sleep hygiene, yes. So you've got 20 seconds. I'm just kidding. but this is all extremely important.
It is. The moderation in diet seems to be the key. There's no magic diet that you can eat that will ensure health and long life. Getting out and moving, especially in natural surroundings, is important, more important than exercise per se. And older adults do need 8 hours sleep. They don't always get it, hence the myth that they only need 5 or 6. And good sleep hygiene is a part of that. And that basically involves going to bed and getting up every day at the same time and creating a situation where you can get that 8 hours, maybe blacking out the curtains in your room, sleeping with earplugs, whatever it takes.
Because there are things as you age that pose challenges when it comes to sleep hygiene.
Right. One of them is the body produces less melatonin, which is the hormone that helps you feel sleepy. And so a number of older adults find it helpful to actually take melatonin 2 hours before bedtime to simulate the body's natural production of it. And then many of us find it helpful to have a bright blue sunlight lamp for 20 minutes in the morning when we wake up, particularly in the northern climates and in the winter, to help reset the chronobiological clock.
What about exercise, though? I know you said, and you say in the book, just a good walk in nature is important, but vigorous exercise, if you're capable of doing it, can help, can it not?
It absolutely can, and it's certainly good for heart health, cardiovascular health, but a lot of people don't stick to vigorous exercise, or they're unable to, and the important message here is that even a little bit of movement has enormous benefits. So don't, you know, here it is the new year, we're thinking about resolutions. Don't punish yourself if you're not running a mile every day or 5 miles or, you know, around the block or whatever it is that was your goal. Anything is better than nothing. If you look at the statistics and the graphs that show the benefits of exercise and movement, the big difference is between doing something and doing nothing. Everything above that is just incremental change.
Sarah in Marysville, we're running out of time, but I wanted to grab your call real quick. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi. I'm 65, and I have a 40-year strategic plan. And for me, it's all about attitude. I have decided that I am never getting old. I'm just going to keep maturing. And the more mature I get, the more I appreciate everything that still works.
She sounds like a poster child for you, Dan Levitin.
Yeah, Sarah, are you doing anything special?
I bought a farm. I have 15 acres. I started a business. I sell jams and honey. You know, if you pick up one of those boxes out at a honey hive, you know, when it's full of honey, it's 60 pounds.
yeah.
So I'm doing some strength training, and I'm keeping real busy.
You're waxing eloquently about the bees.
Yep.
Beeswax, get it? I have a section in the book called Keep Milking the Cows, because a friend of mine told me about her 103-year-old grandmother who died while milking a cow. She had a farm, and she went out there and did it every day. And we all think that she lived that long because she had a purpose and an important role to play on the farm. And that's what we're talking about.
Dan Levitin, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel Levitin is a neuroscientist, a cognitive psychologist. He's the author of a new book. It's called Successful Aging. A neuroscientist explores the power and potential of our lives. Thank you, listeners, for all your great calls. Thank you for listening, as always. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.